Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Discover luxurious duvet sets today. Visit harrycurry.com for stylish comfort this spring.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number. Jim Campion is there. Jim, good afternoon. The national anthem, you think it's being shown disrespect? When, where and how?
Yeah, I know it's there, Joe, over the last few years, especially there. There was an under-20 game there in Cork on Wednesday or Tuesday evening, and Cork and Clare. And it was an example of it. There was fellas jumping around before it and before the anthem was finished. But it seems to be a trend in the day with teams doing that. And
But you say in your note to me here, they were buck lepping during the national anthem.
Yeah, you see fellas stretching and jumping and lepping. And, you know, there doesn't seem to be an attention for it for the couple of minutes that it takes for the anthem. So it seems like there was years ago, you see players and they give it the respect from start to finish. But now it seems it's just a hold up on the sideline that they want to get on with it. But I mean, the couple of minutes it takes for the anthem, I think they should show a bit more respect for it.
But Jim, I thought from an early days in school, a lot of schools would march out into the yard every morning. The national anthem would be played. You'd be stand to attention and the national flag would be raised. But surely from an early age, you know, to stand to attention for our national anthem.
Yeah, we were taught that going to school and how to stand with your arms down by your side and stand to attention for the anthem. Like my feeling about it is it's a bad image for the GAA, both national and internationally, that if we can't respect our national anthem. Like it seems to be only big days in Croke Park that it's, but anywhere else anything goes for fellas running around and all. And our soccer team or international team and the rugby team, when it's being played, in fairness to them, they seem to give it more respect than our GAA players.
Yeah, but I remember reading one of the autobiographies of one of the Irish players, and he was standing for the national anthem. Obviously he was in Lansdowne Road or whatever at the time, or probably Daly Mount, and he turned to a player who was Irish player obviously but wasn't born in Ireland. And the person standing beside me, what is that Albanian national? They were playing Albania. What is that Albanian anthem? It's absolute rubbish. And he had to be corrected by his fellow teammates. And no, that is Aaron Navine. That is our national anthem. So not everyone knows. What about the?
Well, you could excuse fellas that weren't born in Ireland. Maybe they were born in England and playing for Ireland. You know, and they mightn't know the words of it. Like, you can excuse that, but like these Gaelic players, if they don't know, they should actually know it, but at least stand to attention for it. You know.
James Holohan is there as well. 51551 Joe at RT.ie. James, you agree with Jim?
I do, very much so, Joe. I mean, the GAA, when it was founded, and today, you know, its guiding principles, is to promote Gaelic games and the Irish culture. And what Jim said there about the rugby and the soccer lads, you watch that in Lansdowne Road. Mm-hmm. For instance, the 11 soccer players will turn and face the tricolour and they'll sing. Even a person like, say, Bundy Aki on the rugby side, Bundy's from down the Pacific Island somewhere, he has learnt it, he sings it. They stand to attention and they give it respect. Now, the GAA should ensure its players give it respect. And what I mean by give respect is similar to what Jim had said there earlier, that they stand to attention, hands by the side, and wait till it's over. Because it's not just the last few years. It's got worse and worse. What's happened now is it's not just the players, but if you look at the sideline, the managers, selectors, the backroom teams, they all break off now before the end of the national anthem. And they're doing it sooner now than they did before. Some of the players are tying their laces, drinking water, complete lack of respect to it, which is in stark contrast to the way the soccer players and the rugby players do it. And the GAA should do something about that. You know, they have it within their power to do it through their councils to instruct or give directives. that, you know, tell managers and teams this is what they should do, just for the couple of minutes that it takes.
To stand to attention, or, yeah, and face the national flag.
Face the national flag. So, and this might sound drastic, but if they can't do that, show that respect, then don't play it at all. You're better off not playing the national anthem than disrespecting the national anthem. That's my point.
Now, we have a statement from the GAA. I don't know whether to call it a short statement or a short statement, but anyway, here is the statement. It's paraphrase, of course, we've got full respect for the national anthem. We understand that. Acknowledge positive role. We've made stadium announcements at Croke Park and elsewhere, so they're obviously conscious that people are book-lepping, to use Jim's phrase, on our big days to raise awareness of the issue. We're also working on a campaign promoting awareness around the national anthem, and this will be focused on players, members and supporters. And we look forward to rolling out this campaign ahead of peak season championships in the weeks ahead. And we'll also welcome a wider societal discussion how we can work with others to ensure improvement across the boards whenever Aaron Levine has played. Now, the other issue that was, someone stopped me actually on Easter Sunday morning, was about our national flag. And I mentioned this yesterday. Our Defence Forces, as per usual, organised a magnificent service outside the GPO, including the reading of the proclamation. I think it was Captain Conor Gibbons who read it by heart, by the way. He knew it by heart, which was magnificent. There was one flag, rightly so, flying above the GPO. Cleary's across the road, they had five tricolours up on the roof, and that's not allowed. You fly one national flag. It should always be the highest flag in the, if there is a formation, but you fly, they're not a decoration, they're not bunting, you fly a national flag. So I don't know why Cleary's suddenly discovered. But then again, and we've heard other people say, the whole issue of the national flag. I was talking to someone there about a week ago and they said they were going to buy a new house, and they were told part of the deal for buying their new house, they must undertake never to fly the national flag in their garden, any flag. And I thought, you can't hang it out the window. That's not allowed. And that's not respectful. But surely protocol allows every Irish citizen, every household in Ireland, regardless, to actually erect a pole, if you wish, properly, and fly the national flag. Is it legal to say you cannot fly your national flag? John is there. John, good afternoon. There's Joe. John, yeah, the national flag, John.
The national flag. Well, I'm looking out the window, Joe, at the moment, at my flag, flying on my flagpole outside in the front garden, and it's there constantly blowing in the wind.
Well, do you know that new estates around the country are stipulating, even though it's your house, you're paying for it, or mortgage, they're stipulating that you cannot fly the national flag in your own front garden.
But who's saying that? The local residents come at
you? No, the sellers.
The sellers?
The developers. Not everyone, but I'd love to know what their rationale.
Sorry, Joe, but when Mr. Developer goes off with his big bank accounts, which he has made out of the development of such an estate, it's none of his business if I have one of those houses and I'm paying back a mortgage, I can put up a flagpole and I can fly my tricolour.
Once you're flying it properly and sunrise and sundown. If you were told to buy a new property or new house or downsize or upsize or whatever, John, if you were told part of the terms and conditions are you cannot fly the national flag in your front garden, what would you tell them?
Well, I'm a Cork man, so I think you probably know the answer. That's coming right through and through.
Has anyone ever objected to you, John, flying the national flag in your front garden?
I hadn't the flag up long outside my front garden on the pole when there was a lady came up and she was walking her dogs and she remonstrated with me, Joe, and she said, "You shouldn't do that, that's very disrespectful." Of course I didn't know what she was on about. I said, "Excuse me, what are you saying?" She said, "The flag." I said, "What about it?" She said, you shouldn't be flying that outside your house. I said, why? That should be only in public buildings. I said, I'm sorry. I'm entitled to fly as an Irish, sovereign Irish citizen, sovereign Irish Republican, to fly my tricolour outside my property any time I want. It's got nothing to do with you. Please go away. I was very, very respectful, but I just told her politely to go away, Joe.
And you know you're supposed to take it down at sunset. Do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, fair play.
But another thing is, like, what I don't like as well, well, you see people there, even athletes, where they wrap the flag around themselves after winning. Also, when you see people on protest, they wrap the flag around them. And the worst thing of all, when I see people writing stuff on it.
Yeah, that's happening.
You should never write on a sovereign flag. Never.
I wouldn't. I wouldn't see Sonia or any of the other athletes, the younger athletes today. I wouldn't see a problem with them, Rashida. I wouldn't see a problem with any of them if they win a race, holding up the national flag. I think that's a particular.
Holding it up, we'll say maybe that, but wrapping it around you, I think it's disrespectful. Whether you be an athlete, or whether you be at a football match, or whether you be on a protest or whatever. You remember a time, Joe? You remember us in the late '70s when all picture houses, all film houses, at the end of the night when the film was over, the tricolour would come up on the screen, fluttering in the wind, and everyone inside there would wait until the national anthem was over. And it was the same every cabaret show you went to, every dance hall, the band at the end of the night, or single entertainer would play the national anthem. And there was a lot more respect there, a lot more.
In fact, I was reading Keith Donald, you know Keith from Moving Heart, he's brilliant mm-hmm. musician. He's written an incredible book. I hope he gets more publicity, an autobiography. But he, in one of his stories, he was saying they were, could have been somewhere in Northern Ireland, and they finished. And for whatever reason, they forgot to play the national anthem. And the promoter said to them, if you don't go back out and play the national anthem, this place is going to be in trouble. So they had to go back out and play the national anthem. Now, do RTE play it at the end of the night anymore? Remember they used to...
No. Well, obviously, before, years ago, again, you would remember this, television wouldn't be on all night long and stuff like that. I mean, it would finish it before 12 o'clock and the last thing would come up. You'd have the priest would come on with Outlook and then they would play the national flag and you would see the flag fluttering. But that's long gone as well.
Okay. And nightclubs, I presume when nightclubs are indeed dance halls play the national anthem, it was a sign that the show was over and there would be no encores after the national anthem. It was a good full stop to a night.
Otherwise, even the likes of, I was at many of the Woodtones gigs now there, and you know, when they were playing the national anthem, you know, that was it, like they'd come on for one or two encores, but once the national anthem was playing by any group, that was it. And in fairness, even the fellas, no matter how drunk they were, Joe, that time, they would get up if they could hardly even stand, but they would stand for the national anthem.
Now, just you're from Cork, John, I know. Jim, you're accusing some of the Cork players of book lepping during the national anthem.
No, I'm not accusing the Cork players.
Both teams. So you're accusing Cork and Clare.
No, it's just, it's in general, like other county teams as well. I'm not just picking out two teams in particular. But it's just, it was an example of it there during the week, that 121 game. But it's going on, other counties are ahead as well. So it's not just Cork and Clare, no. Absolutely not, no.
John, what would you say if you saw a Cork player book lepping during the national anthem?
Well, obviously, that's down to the manager to instill that into him before. But you can see how fellas are so worried up, I mean, trying to get out. I remember telling the story about Paddy O'Shea when he was fighting up the team so much. Paddy was the first out and he ran at the door with his shoulder, but he didn't realise the door was opening in. And he nearly killed himself.
Good luck. So they are, but as I say, the GAA say we are going to clamp down on it. Jim Campion, if you were to buy a house and you were told, even though it's your house, you were told you cannot fly the national flag in your front garden, how would you react?
Just like that man there from Cork, I'd say, like, I mean, people should be entitled to... If Irish citizens should be entitled to fly the flag if they want to. I don't see why it has to change over the last few years. You know, we're Irish people and we should be proud of our flag and to fly it if we want to. So no one should be able to tell us not to do it.
But often you see it draped over cars, hanging out windows.
It can be overrun, but I mean, yeah, it has to be shown a bit of respect anyway.
Okay, James, Holden and Clare, finally, I presume when you the national flag, you if you were told you couldn't fly it in your front garden, how would you react?
The very same as Jim and John.
Okay.
No, nobody can. If you want to fly your national flag, you can. Anyway, Joe, I'm not aware of any law.
Yeah, neither am I.
It can force you not to fly the national flag. So you tell them to take a hop, skip and jump, you know, and you fly it.
Okay. James, Jim, John, go to meet him. All the J's. James, Jim, John, go to meet him. Joe@rte.ie. Issue of the national flag and at least one developer in the country stipulating that if you buy a house in their estate, even though it's your house, you cannot fly the national flag in your garden, respectfully or otherwise, but respectfully, we presume. Anthony Carey, good afternoon. Anthony, former Army Reserve, you have the protocol about the national flag.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, to serve the Army Reserve, very proud to wear the flag.
Well done.
The flag needs to be revered because of the people that gave their lives so we could have that flag. And in proper flag protocol, that kind of annoys me in terms of it being hijacked by different groups and, you know, shorts and bum cheeks and Pokemon, etc. But the flag protocol in terms of the sun shall never set on the Irish flag. At sunrise in Army Barracks, it's hoisted, and at sunset, it's lowered.
Okay.
But I work nights, Mansion House on Dawson Street. I've seen the flag at night. And I was like, So I went to check this, and the regulations have changed that once the flag is illuminated, it can be flown. And you're more of an authority than I am, but because of during the rising, it would have been flown during the night. So the thinking was that if it's good enough to be flown during the rising at night, it's good enough now once it's illuminated.
Once illuminated. And Anthony, that scenario I said I saw on Easter Sunday morning, I was at the GPO, so this year, not 1960, but this year, and there was five tricolours flying over one building, which is Cleary. So there's only one over the GPO. Is that allowed?
No, the flag needs to be the Irish flag and the EU flag. And the Irish flag has to take prominence.
Of course.
It's the flag of the Irish Republic. And again, it's some people, I think they should be probably taught in school. It's such an important issue, and less people will make that mistake. I'm sure it was, you know, in good faith and celebrating Ireland, etc.
Yeah, okay, but, good point,
I mean, and it's not about the flag itself. It's what it represents and the people who fought and died for it. So, I mean...
And what do you think of this regulation we heard about that a developer is insisting that no one can fly the national flag in their front garden?
I think it's... I wouldn't be taking much advice from developers, especially on when and where to fly. Like, I suppose my opinion would be once it's treated with the
respect, not from the window, not from the washing line, but respectfully. And as we've heard a number of callers already said, I have a proper flagpole. I lower, I raise it, and I lower it appropriately. And that's and by the way, Anthony, you say you're sick of seeing people wearing tricolour shorts, wearing tricolour bum, whatever you call them. Would you check them? Would you say it to them?
Absolutely.
In a
respectful way.
Okay.
I mean, do they understand what that represents?
Yeah.
And maybe with a little bit of knowledge, a little bit of education.
Okay.
You say, well, actually, that's not a good idea to wear shorts of the tricolour and bum cheeks and poke on. It's got a good crack, and I don't think there's any content or feeling about it. But it's, again, that's why maybe we should be thinking about it in schools. I don't think about the American example where the kids are Pledge of Allegiance every morning, but something that, you know, where you came from. Where the country comes from, where it's like, what it represents.
And also, as I said yesterday at the end, how far this country has come. how far this country has come in a very progressive way. Anthony, Dave Maloney wants to make the same point. Anthony just said, were you aware of it, that the flag can, the national flag can be flown at night time once it's properly illuminated, Dave?
Yes, Joe, that, I want to echo what Richard just said. That we were taught as well that the flag, once it's illuminated at night time, can be flown. Okay. That is showing it the due deference, if you like. But we were also taught that the flag couldn't touch the ground.
Yes, yes.
And it was being, yeah, and that there is a specific way as well amongst the military to fold the flag, to have it properly folded.
Of course, yeah.
And kept. Yeah.
And I don't know. I'm trying to remember an incident. It was an event that was starting in Trinity College in Front Square, and the starting flag, and I think it was a Taoiseach, was the national flag. And he waved the flag, but the flag touched the ground. And there was uproar. Yeah. There was uproar.
To be frowned upon.
Okay.
I think there's a paragraph somewhere in our curriculum is all it would take. Just one paragraph somewhere in the curriculum, Joe, with just how to treat the national flag or any national flag with respect and deference.
And the history of the flag in itself is fascinating. Thomas Marr, and there's a fantastic organisation called the Thomas Marr Foundation who write about the national flag. Dave Maloney, good to meet you, Morgan, and thank you for your service. And Ciarán is as well.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Don't ask me how it started, but 2 days ago it was Bridget, wasn't it? She mentions that we first met at the Ballyduff Amdram Festival in 19-whatever, and we were calling it, and she was professing her love of amateur dramatics, which is primarily, as far as I can see, a rural phenomenon in Ireland. And then I mentioned the Dean Crow Theatre, the RTE Amdram Festival, which is on as we speak, and it's been going, wait for it, since 1953. Isn't that incredible? And RTE have been sponsoring it ever since, which is fantastic. And I was just saying during the promo, does Amdram make a difference to your life? And Helena Stout is in Selbridge in Dublin, just outside Dublin, in County Kildare. Helena.
How are you, Joe?
Good. How did it change your life?
Oh, Joe, Amdram, 14. I got involved with the Phoenix Players down Tubbercurry, where I'm from.
Okay.
And they were doing the circus, and I begged my mum and dad, Tom and Maureen down there, could I travel with them?
Right.
And they said yes. And at that time, probably 80s, I'd probably never been further than Mosney. So around the country with the drama group.
Wow.
I felt like Elizabeth Taylor. And we qualified for the All-Ireland down in West Cork, and that was the start of my love for drama and theatre in general. So, yeah, it's been a huge part of my life for the last 30, 40 years.
And Helena, what age did you say you were when your parents let you off?
I know, but not Joe, but 30 or 40. Sure, you know, it was a lovely bunch of people. It took care of me. I felt so sophisticated. I still remember that feeling, even though I'm in my late 50s. I still remember that absolute feeling. I think it stayed with me my whole life.
And are you still part of the Amdram movement?
Yeah, actually, Joe, I can't
the Amdram community.
Here. I am, because I'm on stage in the Dean Crow tomorrow night.
Oh, brilliant.
With Brad on Players in Little Gem, and I actually talk about you.
Oh, good luck. It's a tragedy, is it?
No, it's not. Little Gem by Elaine Murphy. And she talks about bringing the radio and Joe Duffy into the bedroom, Joe.
Oh, good luck. Okay. That's called.
That's fortuitous. It's amazing.
And now, just in terms of putting that production together, Helena.
Yeah.
Who builds the sets? Who does all?
Well, there is our struggle now, Joe, because we're a very small group. And what you'll find is in Selbridge, Maynooth, Lucan, and Leixlip, we actually have no theatre.
Okay.
We actually have no rehearsal space.
Wow.
We really don't have the facilities. The likes of the drama groups down the country are really lucky to have, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I often wonder, is it because we're too near Dublin? You know, all the professional theatres or the We do it in our kitchens. We rehearse in our kitchens. Radine, who's directed, Michelle, Stevie and myself, who are in it, we've rehearsed this play in our kitchens. We hadn't the facility to build a big set this time. We just don't have the money or the resources. So we had to be very smart and think outside the box and produce something a little bit more stylized and simple. In other drama groups, huge, there are teams behind everybody. The whole community is involved, and it's wonderful to see.
I opened the Carnoo Drama Festival about five weeks ago.
The set
was incredible.
Yeah,
was incredible. You wouldn't you wouldn't see in Dabby. You wouldn't see it in the Gate. The set was so brilliantly made.
That's where you'll see the big sets, because you'll find you're not seeing them so much in the professional theatres, because they've got such team, such community spirit. Yeah. Everybody from everywhere, all helping, doing their bit. So that's where you will see the big sets, and they're amazing. Some of them are amazing.
And there is a story, Helene, I don't know if it's true, that goes around the Amdram community that there was a set on a stage. It was in Kerry. And part of the set was a bar, and in the corner of the bar, Marja, was the toilet. And
I know the play.
And every now and again, one of the actors would obviously pretend, "I'm going to the loo." And then during the actual performance, someone got up from the body of the hall, walked up the aisle, up the side steps, and walked across and went into the loo, thinking it was the loo.
Well, that's a sign they did a very good production.
They sure did.
The audience felt they were part of it.
They really were.
Yeah.
And the first time I ever saw this next man was in the Dean Crowe Theatre many, many years ago. He'll remind me of the... It's the Martin McDonagh play about the letter. What's that called, Seamus? The Beauty Queen of Lynan, is it?
The Beauty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Queen of Lynan, yeah.
And that was actually our last production. We put it on in Tala Little Theatre. Fabulous play.
Now, we all know Seamus. Seamus, up to about, 12 weeks ago, you weren't even a household name in your own household. you're now known, thankfully, the length and the breadth. Now, when I saw you in the Dean Crowe, what were you doing in real life?
I think at the time that was about a year before I actually went full-time into the theatre business. I was managing a company at the time.
Okay.
But I started out as I was originally a cabinet maker or a carpenter.
Okay, I remember that. Yeah.
And that's how I got dragged into the amateur drama scene, not for my talent, but for my skills and the fact that I had access to a van. And then they were stuck for someone to do a very small part. And that's the first time I ever set foot on the stage, and I was almost 25 at that stage. I was a very quiet young fella, and so that's how I got into the.
And up to then, Seamus, I know you're a great sports person. I'm reading through your books, but had you any interest? Did you ever see yourself as an actor?
No, not at all. No, but I'll tell you our family always went to our local drama group at the time was called the Carrigallen Community Players, which later on turned into the Cornmill Theatre Players. But so every year in the spring, we'd go to the local play, which would be supposed to be at 9 o'clock, and it wouldn't start till about 9:40.
Okay.
And we'd be brought in there. But it was first of all, we didn't get to many places, and to get into our local hall and a packet of Emerald Sweets were bought for the four of us, the four kids, and that was enough of a treat in itself. And then we were left sitting watching this curtain for 3/4 of an hour, because nothing ever started on time at that stage. But there was there was some sort of magic. There was, because this curtain was bulging every now and again. and some fella would look out to see was there Manny in the audience. And there was this great sense of, you know, waiting and my father grumbling, will it ever start? And he was thinking of having to get up in the morning to milk cows and all sorts. But I always remember when that curtain was pulled back and just the sense of the magic of theatre. And back then, most of the plays were big, long plays and changed setting three times, maybe. So there were, it was still called the three-act festival. So there were three acts and the set was changed three times. But each time, it was just this. We were fascinated as kids that how could this magic happen? Now, it didn't happen instantly because I had a great love for theatre long before. I'd never thought I'd do it or anything like that. But anyway, when I was 25, my football and days were I was getting injured and all sorts, and I was kind of at a loss for something to do, and so mm-hmm. I got dragged into the theatre and never looked back, and I've had such fantastic times on the amateur.
When did you say to yourself, because I presume you initially said, am I any good at this? When did you say to yourself, Seamus, actually, I'm not bad at this?
Yeah, that's a really good point you make, because I was given a talk recently and was trying to think back on who encouraged me in my early life. There wasn't too many. You certainly wouldn't get encouraged at home to do something like become an actor. I mean, it's on a par with snooker. Like, where are you going? off of that crowd of useless people. But I think that, first of all, I got a bug, and that was this little small part that I did the first year. I never experienced anything like going out in front of people. And I know we all see this, but I was a shy young fella. But I just loved that excitement of sticking out my chest and saying what I had to say and not being myself for 5 minutes, you know, which was, that was the thing for me. And so I went from that to the next year playing the main part, which was kind of mad, but, And of course, one of the, I call it, it can be either a positive or a negative. One of the things with the amateur drama scene is every festival you go to, you've got an adjudicator who will talk about everybody, and then there are acting awards and all sorts. So in one sense, that's great, and it's great encouragement for the people who win those awards. For the people who don't win them, it's a kind of saying, you're not just good enough yet, you know. So I have to say, it wasn't until I had won a couple of them that I began to think, well, maybe I'm better at this than I thought. It's those people that kind of say to you, when nobody else is saying it, that yes, you have a talent. I don't think that word is ever mentioned that much with my name, or hasn't been, but it gradually grew on me over a few years that I was doing all right.
Yeah. And as we know now, snooker players and actors, they're part of the elite. But Seamus, I remember what I loved about Amdram. This happened relatively recently near Coolgraney, of a great Amdram group, and all around Gorey and Wicklow, Wexford, the great Amdram groups. And I remember I went to it was actually the year of the Hiker, that great John B. Keane played the Hiker Lacey. And first of all, the announcement was, by the way, the actor, Paddy, whatever, I'm making up a name now, Paddy Murphy, who's due to play one of the sons, I think. The cow is calving and he can't leave the farm. So the part will be read by Mickey Maguire, and he actually had the script for the and it worked. It did work because people accommodated it. And the second thing they said was, by the way, for all of you here tonight, the emergency exits are in the same place as they were before COVID. Where would you get it? Tommy Maron, come in, Tommy. The legendary Tommy Maron from Midwest Radio. You write plays, don't you, Tommy?
I do, Joe. I actually wrote my first play when I was 13 in secondary school, believe it or not. And thereafter, again, like one of your previous callers who was involved with the Phoenix Players in Tubbercurry, I was involved with them as well. And then after school, you know, you go to work, you have to make a living. But I always had this urge to, and my difficulty with Amdram was you would spend 4, 5, 6 months rehearsing, doing all of the learning of the lines. You did 3 nights in your local hall, and then it was all over. And I thought to myself, you know, I would just love to do something whereby I can still work, do my day job, and get involved in drama at a different level. So I sat down and I wrote a play called It's the Real McCoy. And it proved to be really successful. And we dabbled, you know, because I'm in the west of Ireland, we said, look, we'll do a night or two in the Hawkswell, Sligo, we'll do a night in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway. And they went really, really well. And we ended up doing like over 100 performances of It's the Real McCoy all over Ireland.
Incredible.
We went to America twice and we went to England.
But how do you fund all this?
Well, it's funded through, obviously, the fact that we get audiences, Joe.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, and for example, as I speak to you, I'm on my way to Glore in Ennis tonight.
Okay,
we're presenting one of my plays called Matches and Old Flames. And that's on tonight in Glore in Ennis. I hope you don't mind me giving it the free plug. There are still a few tickets left.
Right.
And then next week we're in the Town Hall Theatre in Galway for 2 nights. And all of our cast are like, they're amateurs. You know, we've somebody who's a former chef. We have a builder, we have a jeweller. They've all been part and parcel of what we've done. I wrote a play called Three Hail Marys, which was on for a week in the Olympia 4 years ago. And we're actually bringing that back again in September. So, you know, that's what we do. It's not our full-time, you know, living. It's an amateur drama group called Crokey Plays, and we just tour the country.
And people love it. People love it. But am I right in thinking it is primarily a non-Dublin phenomenon?
Although having said all that, a great guy called Donal Sheila, I don't know if you know Donal from Verdant Productions, he came to see my play, Three Hill Heaven, and he looked at the audience, and you're right, it is predominantly a rural audience that tend to go, but he looked at the audience and he said, you know something, this works in the city, and that's why we did 6 shows, sellout shows, in the Olympia. We've also done the Everyman in Cork, you know, the big theatres. We've done the ball. And it's a kind of a phenomenon that, you know, people scratch their heads now and they say, sure, how can a local, you know, group of individuals, amateurs, go around the country and do so well? But there is actually a market for what I do, which is very clean, Irish, predominantly rural comedy.
I just want to stick with that topic there about money, if I can. Helena, I presume you have to pay, first of all, the playwright, to perform the play.
Absolutely, and rightly so.
Do you play per performance, or do you pay per the size of the audience?
No, per performance, Joe.
Okay.
Doesn't matter how, now, there are like, you know, like 0 to 150, 150 to 200 different bands. But if we were going out traveling the country and you had 8 performances, you know, you'd pay the rights for that, and then all of your, say, runs coming up to Athlone, or even amateur drama groups putting on local shows, you pay the rights, you know. So without amateur drama, really, there's an awful lot of Irish playwrights, you know, who probably wouldn't have developed, or even, you know,
that's
kept their career in the country, you know.
That's where John B. began. That's where John B.
and Tom
began.
Murphy and Brian Friel.
Geniuses.
Yeah, and I think they do always acknowledge amateur drama as part of the success of getting their plays out there as well.
Helena,
you know?
So somebody has told us, are you the same Helena that won the All-Ireland Best Actress in 2014 for her role in Who's Afraid of Helena Stout? No, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Oh, yeah.
Hold on.
What that has to say now?
Wasn't it Elizabeth Taylor who played it in the? Did you watch?
I told you, I felt like Elizabeth Taylor at 13. It was meant to be.
Did you study Elizabeth?
I think she's a fabulous actress, I have to say. Yeah. But I love that play. That play is just a real American classic, you know, and it was a pleasure to bring it to the stage, you know.
Yeah, great stuff. Seamus, where are you performing at the minute?
I'm doing my 6 one-man shows in the Corn Mill in 2 weeks' time.
Okay.
Over the weekend, two shows every night for 3 nights. So that's my I don't know why I'm doing that, but that's what I'm doing anyway. And I'm all around the country doing bits and pieces, right, and I'm recording my books now for audio.
Books are, I think, for nearly a year now, Leaning on Gates and Minding the Gap, Standing in Gaps. both of them have been in the top 10 for many months.
Delighted, yeah. And there's quite a bit about the amateur
drama in that. That's right, I remember
Leaning on Gates. Yeah.
Reading about that. And your colleague from Funny Friday, Paddy O'Callaghan, the great Paddy O'Callaghan, is currently on tour with his one-man show, which is getting rave reviews, and he's coming to Dublin, the Civic Theatre, in a few months, about the great storyteller Eamon Kelly. I hope I'm getting the name right. And apparently he's another great stuff. Okay, good to meet you, Margaret. Seamus, keep going. Seamus O'Rourke. Helena, are you in Athlone?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Okay. And is there...
And can I just say best of luck to all the 8 other groups. Every single one of them deserves their place. Well done to them all.
And there's some great plays. Lend Me
Fabulous.
A Tenor by Ken Ludwig. Conor McPherson. Little Jam by Elaine Murphy. The Weir. There's two different groups doing The Weir. That'll be hard to judge. Batty Duff Drama, where this conversation began 2 days ago, are doing the Blackwater
Wonderful
Lightship by the great Colm Tobin. And then Wexford are doing Skylight by David Hare. And Ball Alley players are doing Ulster American. It's great.
And
check me, the Bridge Drama are doing this is very ambitious. The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. The New Point players are doing Get Her. What a week.
Absolutely. Good luck to everybody.
And
Helena,
but Helena, you know, after the Golden Globes and the Emmys, like, is there a big... Is there big celebrity parties and party packs and red carpets and free champagne?
I'd love to tell you, Joe, but you know what happens the Monday after? What are we going to do next year?
Well done. Yeah. James.
I will be taking you tomorrow. Thanks
very much. James in Dublin. Good to meet you, Margaret, Helena. James.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Well, what did you go and see?
Well, first of all, Joe, congratulations on your big decision and best wishes for your retirement.
Into amateur drama, I hope, by the sounds of it.
Go
to meet him, Margaret. You're very kind, James.
So you saw a
performance of The Weir.
Yeah, just by chance, I was in Tallow County, Waterford last Saturday, saw a sign for The Weir, a local production by the Brideview Drama Group. Don't know anything about them. Never went to amateur drama in West Waterford before.
Yeah.
But just the sign caught my eye. Tickets on the door, and my wife and I and two friends went to see the show at 8 o'clock last Saturday night.
Brilliant.
And it was fantastic.
And there's a pub. It's a pub, isn't it? Set in a pub, primarily.
The set. There were no curtains to be drawn back. So as you went into the community hall, to take your seat, you were sitting looking up at the stage.
Yeah.
And the stage was a pub from the 1970s.
Brilliant.
And you got to take it all in and see the set and absorb it and love it before the acting began.
Isn't that fantastic?
It was like going back to the 1970s.
Well done. Brilliant.
The pub signage.
Everything. The detail is incredible.
Doors that give entry from the public, from the outdoors,
just
so to speak.
Incredible,
And the lights. And you just would have to say it was just a joy to watch.
Well said.
And that was before
well
we got to the acting.
That's what, that's the Brideview Drama Group. They're also in the RTE. Finals, they're performing.
I think they may have progressed to the finals.
Yeah, they have,
and
they're performing The Weir. They're performing The Weir by the wonderful Conor McPherson in the next few days in Athlone.
It wasn't just the set, to be fair. The five actors were so full of character and such skill and talent, they would all be Oscar candidates.
Well, so that's
absolutely
what
brilliant.
What a lovely endorsement of amateur
and
dramatics.
I, I was just passing through on a May evening.
I just rambled in.
The entertainment caught our eye went to it. It was such joy,
okay.
Such fun.
Well said, James. Well said. That's James in Dublin. Joe at RT.ie. Trish Boyce, Trish, back to Amdram.
Hello, Joe.
You were on stage.
Hello, Joe.
How are you? You were on stage last night, Trish.
On stage last night, Joe, we had a super night. So I am part of Ballycogley Players Drama Group from the sunny southeast here in Wexford, just home from Athlone. And by golly, we had a super night.
Great, brilliant.
Both on and off the stage. We had the honour of opening the RT All-Ireland Drama Finals last night. And what an honour it was.
And has Amdram had much effect on your life?
Well, look, Joe, I'll be honest with you. As a group, we're celebrating 50 years this year, which is a huge achievement. But I'm 19 years with the group, and I have to say it's been just a whirlwind. Absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And what a special group of people and friends that I have.
Isn't that
just
fantastic?
Amazing.
Oh, you actually, what I didn't know, when you perform in Athlone, you go home to Wexford that night.
Yes, no, we I'm just home literally about 10 minutes ago. Oh,
okay.
So we said last night, and so we had a bit of fun on stage and off stage.
Great,
you can imagine a few stepping-ups for her afterwards.
Of course. And when will you know?
Well,
the
results. Obviously the remaining 9 groups qualify, so 8 groups still have to perform. So we will have results on Saturday week, the 17th, in the Radisson up in Athlone. So we're keeping everything crossed. But look, we've done our best now. We've
done
our best show last night.
Here.
So, yeah, up Wexford.
Where's Mags Whiteley down in Kilkenny? Mags.
Joe, how are you?
You're involved in the Barnell Players, a well-known group in Kilkenny.
I am indeed, yes. We are currently in production with a new piece by Seamus Scanlon, a writer from Galway who lives in New York, at a piece called the McGowan Trilogy.
Okay, and is Amdram, has it changed your life?
Oh, hugely. I started out with a local group in Paulstown in Kilcomedy Players, and then Barnstorm Theatre ran an adult theatre club for people who were interested in getting involved in drama. And sort of a training course over 2 years. So I did that with them it's about 15, 16 years ago now. And so I've been involved with Amdram in that space since then. And like we've done a lot of different things. During COVID, we did Love in Lockdown and a call out to writers to write pieces. And yeah, so we've been doing a lot over the last number of years.
But were you always bound for the stage, Max? Seamus O'Rourke was telling us he never even thought about it before he accidentally started. Were you always keen to get on?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I accidentally came upon it in Gore's Bridge in 1998.
Okay.
They were doing a commemoration of 1798, and they were doing a pageant, and they sent out a call out for people, and I just went down and said I'd move furniture or paint the set or do whatever needed to be done, and that's how I ended up getting into acting.
Fantastic.
And then to improve it, I joined the Adult Theatre Club with Barnstorm Theatre in Kilkenny. And that's where we've gone from there. So our latest production then is going to be in Thomastown, opening on Thursday.
And what
is in Thomastown Concert Hall.
And the play is?
It's called The McGowan Trilogy by
Seamus
Scanlon.
That's the same one, yeah. Okay,
yeah,
well done, well done in Thomastown. Well, that's Mags Whiteley and all the other people who contacted us about this wonderful, wonderful activity of amateur drama in Ireland. On sound today, James Feeney, BCO, Mary Elizabeth Bruton, research by Richie Byrne, the series producer is Annette Egan. Today's show was produced by Rachel Graham, and Ray Darcy is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And again, just a little notice that we are going to be talking about very difficult subject. So if you do have young ears in your company, you may decide that you want to listen to it later on the podcast. or you want to listen to it in a different setting. But we are talking again about penile cancer, because we've been contacted by so many men, and indeed women, about it. But women who spotted it and insisted brilliantly, as we heard yesterday from Margaret, that her partner, Vincent, should move very, very quickly and get it dealt with. And that pathway they're on at the minute, and hopefully it will speed up for them, as they said. Brian is in Athy. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
You and this wonderful medic, Ivor Cullen's been mentioned again. Tell us your story. You were with Ivor.
Yes. Well, initially I went to my own doctor, Joe, back on the 5th of March to get the results of my twice annual blood test. And he said, fair play to him, a young doctor, and he said, by the way, Brian, he said, is there anything else you wanted to chat to me about or ask me about? And so I took the opportunity to mention to him about the problem I had with my penis, which I noticed actually last Christmas.
Okay.
And so I didn't do anything about it because, like being a typical man, I suppose, it wasn't painful or causing me any discomfort. So I just said, that's fair enough. I'll mention it now to this man. And I did. And he said, let me have a look. And he did, and straight away, without saying anything about it or making any comment on it, he said, I'm going to refer you to Ivor Cullen down in the Artheven Hospital in Kilkenny. He said, do you know where the Artheven is, or have you heard of it? I said, I do. I said, I was in it 20 years ago for a hernia operation, so I said, I know exactly where it is. He said, that's fine. So I got the letter to go down to Ivor on Wednesday, just gone there, and I went down to see Ivor, and I walked in, and being in the same age bracket as your good self, I said to, when I was sitting down, I said, hello, Mr. Cullen. And he put up his hand like the guard, and he said to me, one second now, he said, my name is Ivor Cullen. He says, call me Ivor.
Right.
So that's fair.
Yeah.
So anyway, he sat me down and he said, what's the problem? And I told him it was the foreskin and the penis was sticking to the head of the penis since last Christmas. And I said, it wouldn't separate. So he said, can you look at that? And I gave him a look at it, and he then gave me, he said, fair enough. He said, get dressed there. And he said, I'll give you the two options now. One is I give you a steroid cream that you can separate the foreskin yourself. And he said, you'll have to use a good bit of force. And then when I heard that, I said, I don't know what the amount of force is going to be necessary for this. So I said, what's the other option? He said, the other option, Brian, is, he said, you get get your foreskin removed, get a circumcision.
Okay.
And I said, that's okay with me. And he said, it's a day case procedure. So he said, you'll be only here for a couple of hours. He said, and I said, well, I have to get someone to bring me down. Oh, by all means, you will, because you will be knocked out completely. And he said, it'll be a death case procedure now. He said, when do you want to get it done? So I said, well, not before the end of June, because I'm driving a bus and I don't want to interrupt that schedule. So he said, fair enough. And he said, I have the 9th of July. And he said, I said, that'll do me fine. I'll take the 9th of July. And he said, that's great. And then he wrote it down and he said, oh, by the way, he said, that condition that you have, he said, if it's left untreated like you have it there, he said, we don't know what's going on under that. He said, you don't know, certainly, and I don't know. And he said, the thing is, he said, without treatment, he said, that can lead, he says, to penile cancer. And I thought, oh, my God. And he could see the shock in my face, probably. So he said, yeah, but he said, there's nothing to worry about. He said, you made the right move to get it looked at. And he said, you're getting it corrected. So he said, that's the story there. So then, that
and
was
you,
grand. Had
you ever heard of penile cancer?
Joe, I never heard of penile cancer in my life. It was the one cancer I've heard, obviously, of all the other cancers.
Like
lung cancer and pancreatic cancer and colon cancer and all the rest, unfortunately. I never heard of penile cancer in my life. And then yesterday when I was leaving the house, picking up my phone off the table and radio was on in the kitchen, and I heard the contributor there, which was good self, talking about penile cancer. And straight away, I was locked in on the conversation. Mm-hmm. So I rushed out to the car. I had to go. I rushed out to the car and I heard Ivor Cullen's name being mentioned. And I thought, oh, my God, this is unreal. Twice in the space of 24 hours, I'm after hearing the phrase penile cancer. And I said, this is something I'm going to have to make contact with the programme about, because I never heard of it before and I'm sure there are loads of men out there who haven't.
But Brian, just in terms of dates, and this is by no way of criticism, so bear with
me.
It's about education. Between the time you spotted the problem with your foreskin and the time you went to and you said, when your GP said, by the way, Brian, anything else, what was that duration?
That duration was roughly from the beginning of last December, Joe. So it's, you're talking 6 months.
Okay.
You know, so, and so I you know, and in, when I had the because I live on my own, I said it to my good friend, Colm. He's a farmer, and I met him out in the yard one day, and I said to him, by the way, I said, do you mind if I talk to you about something? And he said, no, work away. We know each other since we were only teenagers. So anyway, we got talking, and sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional. But
take your time.
I got talking to him, and I explained to him about the foreskin thing and the whole lot. And we were in his yard, in his farmyard. And I said, do you mind if I show it to you just so that you know what you're looking at? Oh, he says, I don't mind. He says, so we're all the one, he says.
So
I showed him, and he says, well, Brian, he says, there's one thing for sure. He says, I'm no doctor, but he says, and neither are you. But he says, that's not right. And I know you're doing the right thing by getting it looked at. You know, but I had to tell someone, and I hadn't told my sister or my two brothers at that stage. And when I made contact with the program out of awareness for other people, I said, but now I have to tell my sister at least, because she'll have to drag me down, even though she didn't know it at the time. I rang my two brothers then and explained it to them. And they were so glad that I was making the proper move to get it looked after, you know.
Well done.
And that's the first time I ever heard of it, was on Wednesday last. And then the second time was on your program yesterday at lunchtime, and that was unbelievable. I was stuck to the ground in the kitchen when I heard it the second time in 24 hours.
And I'm really conscious of what you said there, that you ended up and you had the courage just because you're a single man in that sense.
Yeah.
But so you said it to your best buddy, to another man. You just said, listen.
I did.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And I know him all my life.
Well, that says a lot about
he's not the kind of guy that would be broadcasting it in the pub. He's ex-Garda, so he keeps his business to himself, and he keeps other people's business as discussed to himself as well.
Okay.
And he's brilliant.
Stay with us, Brian. Ciarán, it was 2008, and you describe it as good afternoon,
Joe.
Good afternoon. You say it was an awful experience.
Terrible experience, and like that gentleman you're speaking to there now, I had never heard of it at that time either. And I contacted my GP, and she immediately sent me to a urologist in Cork, Mr. Ryan, and that all happened within a couple of weeks. And he did a biopsy and confirmed that it was cancerous. And then about a week or two after that, the inevitable had to happen, which it did. But there was nothing, no one to turn to at the time, no one to talk to apart from close family, kids and my wife. And, it was a bad time in life, but I got over it.
And when you say the inevitable, when you say the inevitable...
That's exactly it, Joe, the inevitable.
And for a man to hear it, for it to happen to a man, and then for another man to hear it, and indeed for anyone to hear about it, it meant the amputation of your complete penis.
Correct.
Yeah.
And my heart went out to that gentleman yesterday, Vincent, that he has no one to speak to. But
and he had his Margaret, his wife. Yeah, she's brilliant. And he was very appreciative of people like yourself who were talking yesterday. So Ciarán, when you tell your pals that you've had carcinoma of the, you don't, okay?
I don't. A few probably do know or have known in the past, but I get over it, and it's a case of living without it or not living at all. That's the way it is. And even with the amputation, you still had to go through the lymph nodes to have them checked.
Yeah, of course.
And that was another operation, of course. And luckily enough, it hadn't travelled to the lymph nodes. So there was another man did that. He was Hugh Flood in Limerick.
And Ciarán, did you know before you went in for the surgery Did you know that the outcome was going to be the complete removal?
I did, Joe. I did. I knew that.
And when you were told that initially, how did you cope with that? Or did anyone help you cope? Or how did you deal with that or understand it or contemplate?
There was no other choice, Joe, okay, except have it done. And that was it.
Okay. Because this is the point we're trying to make here on, and you're making it so strongly and so vividly, unfortunately, from your experience. And that is penile cancer. A lot of cancers now, once detected earlier, they can be early, they can be dealt with chemo and radio. But penile cancer, you really need to get to your GP rapidly and get into the system.
Rapidly.
And then it can be dealt with. Otherwise, it can be extraordinarily challenging. And as we heard yesterday, I'm not a medic, but we heard from Holly Neuralic, the medic, the expert in London, originally from Ireland. But she was saying, as of yet, there's no medication as such to treat it. So it's surgery to try and deal with it, remove as little as possible, but as much as necessary. And the longer it can advance very, very, very quickly. And Ciarán, I know it doesn't come up, but when you say you don't really tell people, is that deliberate or just simply it doesn't arise in conversation?
It just doesn't arise in the conversation. And anyway, most people can't deal with it. I found it hard enough to deal with it, and I found it hard enough for to talk to people about it. So I just don't.
What, they wince?
They do, yes. And of course, they'd be apologetic. But I say I told no more than a half dozen people in the last 17 years. So it just doesn't matter at this stage. Just get on with life and do what you have to do. But I do know that if it's left untreated, there's only one outcome.
Yeah. And as you're saying, what's the difference? The difference is 17 years so far and more to come, please God.
With the help of God.
Yeah.
Well, it hasn't given me any bother since.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Ciarán, for talking about it, and Brian. Brian, by the way, who did you tell first? I know you mentioned it to your GP.
Outside of
your buddy,
my doctor telling me, it was my good friend Colm I told first. Yeah, he was the first person I told.
Well, that was
At that stage, I had made contact with that wonderful man, Ivor Cullen, down in North Eden, and and I couldn't be thankful enough that I was referred to him. Obviously, couldn't be thankful enough. The highest regard for those consultants.
Yeah, and thank you, Brian, and thank you, Ciarán. Onwards.
Thanks for taking the call.
And thanks for making the call. That's Ciarán O'Brien. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
So we have a new Papa Leo. He's a very young man, as you know. 69. He's 135 days older than myself, I hasten to add. But who's counting? Susan Cross. Susan. Are you there?
Hello.
Susan?
Hi,
where were you yesterday when you suddenly heard the rumour?
I was in. I had just taken my son to the orthopaedic surgeon.
Uh-huh.
He hurt his knee playing football, heard it on the radio, and then I went to Piazza San Pietro.
Okay, but what part of Rome were you in when you heard the radio saying the white smoke is coming?
I was near my son's apartment, so I was about 20 minutes drive from San Pietro.
Okay. And you drove through the evening traffic in Rome, which
mad woman, with two girlfriends.
Yes. Was it obvious that people were descending on St. Peter's Square?
Oh, my God. It was chock-a-block. Everybody went in that direction.
And were you not thinking, as you're driving and weaving, am I going to abandon the car in St. Peter's Square?
No, what did I do? I abandoned it outside the Irish Embassy and jumped into a taxi with another person in it. because all the taxis were busy, but this taxi had one guy in it. And okay. I said to him, do you mind? Are you going to the Vatican? Can we jump in with you? So the three of us jumped in with him.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
And he took us to the Vatican, left us outside the columns, and we ran like the clappers. And we got there just in time, just before he came out.
That, and that was the ticking clock you wanted to beat. The white smoke, yeah, and then the gap between the white smoke and the new pontiff standing on the balcony.
On the balcony, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And when did you know when he came out who he was?
Mm-hmm. No, we didn't. And everybody in the crowd was saying, who is it? And there was every nationality around us. And I do speak three languages, so I had to keep asking every tourist, did you know? No. And okay, there was no line. We know because everybody in the piazza was sending their Instagrams and their photos and their messages. So there was no actual line. So we couldn't find out on internet. So we had to wait. And then one of the security guards told us they were holding the crowd back. They told us it was the Americano.
Okay.
And we were not very happy about that, I have to say, because we were kind of rooting for the Italian.
Well, you see, there was a number of Americanos. And it wasn't Cardinal Prevost or Robert Prevost that was being mentioned. If you looked up, which I did, what I did was probably a sin, Susan. I looked up the bookies over the last.
Oh,
I did. Over the last few days, I was looking up Paddy Power and Boyle, and I was saying,
"Were you going to make a bet?"
That would only be broken and revealed under the seal of the confessional when I'm begging for forgiveness. But anyway, Robert Prevost didn't feature, but the American cardinal that did feature, I think he was 25-1, was Timothy Dolan, mm-hmm, from New York, who would have been Trump's candidate.
Is
that what you thought, that it was Timothy Dolan that had got? Yeah, okay.
Yes. That's what we thought. So we were all very disappointed, especially the Italians around me. And there were Americans, there were Argentinians, there were lots of different nationalities all around us. And anyway, we didn't discover his name until like a good mm-hmm. while afterwards. And then actually he turns out to be, he seems to be a really nice kind of gentle type of man.
Yeah.
And I've heard him interviewed in English and in Italian, and he speaks excellent Italian, which I'm very pleased about. And he seems to be a very affable type of nice man. So we'll give him a chance, even though he's American.
Get up. We love Americans. We do.
And my very close American friend is with me here. I'm in Tuscany. We came up this morning. Okay. She landed this morning.
As you do.
Well, I'm a very happy retiree.
Well done.
So she's a working lady, but she's here for the weekend and we're having a lovely time. And it was so exciting yesterday, though. The atmosphere was amazing. It was like being at a rock concert, but, you know, I'm not that religious, but let's say I'm religious enough.
Okay. Now, I heard someone say this morning, mm-hmm. because he's so young, this person said to me, oh, my God, I hope he's not my last pope. In other words...
Oh, he could, because he'd be around for a while, I think. He looks very healthy. That's and
funny. Well, the person who said this to me was healthy as well. I said, it's a funny way to look at it. Yeah, she said, I just hope that's not my last pope.
Well, he could be. But listen, if he's a good man, we'll be happy to keep him on.
Yeah. Please, God.
Yeah, he seems like a nice person, gentle and soft. And he talked a lot about his childhood, growing up in Chicago, of immigrant parents. And he was in a very religious family.
Yeah.
And apparently his brother was joking with him when he was only 6 or 7 about becoming Pope because he was that religious.
Yes, that's true. And he has a brother who has been talking, especially, which is great, to the American media about Mary brought it up on Morning Oil this morning about a question I'd never think of asking, fair play, which Chicago apparently is divided among is a baseball teams and NFL teams, and you're either one or the other. And he revealed that he was a White Sox supporter. And then Claire Bourne discovered an Irish connection. Was it the man the man in Tipperary Pope Leo came in to have his lunch one day, believe it. Where else would you go? I'm sure by Tuesday morning he'll be half Irish. Please, God.
Okay. I think he already is half Irish. But anyway, hopefully he'll be a nice man, Joe.
Yeah, hopefully. Very important position, to say the least, for so many, the billion and a half Catholics in the world and beyond as well. Good to meet you, Margaret. Susan Cross. Thank you, Susan. Joe at rte.ie 51551. Wash your hands.